Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is failure drummer Kelly Scott. But first, let's talk about Billboard's new chart. Billboard now has a chart for lyrics. And frankly, I scratch my head about this, but it really does make some sense. So first of all, they're doing this in conjunction with the website called LyricFind. And actually, LyricFind does a very interesting service, provides a very interesting service for music publishers. What they do is they license lyrics online, and they provide sync licenses, and they also report back on exactly how much money they're making through lyrics. This is a very small part of a publisher's business, and as a result, they really like LyricFind to do this because that's what they specialize in. So it really works to everybody's benefit. So anyway, since LyricFind specializes in lyrics, they're actually the perfect choice for a partner for this particular chart. So now we have the Billboard LyricFind lyric chart. And what this is based on is the number of searches for a particular lyric for a song. The interesting part is they found that just about as many searches occur for the lyrics of a song as for the songs itself. So this is actually pretty important. It turns out, though, that the lyric chart closely mirrors the Hot 100 chart. So whatever seems to be hot on the Hot 100 chart, on the singles chart, is also hot on the lyric chart. So as a result, what we have is Adele and Drake and One Direction and Ariana Grande, who are on top of the lyric chart and also at the same time in the top 10 of the Hot 100 chart. Anyway, this is a step in the right direction because, once again, lyrics mean so much to a song, and many times, and especially in pop music, they become undervalued. I get the feeling from a lot of lyrics that I hear that people don't spend enough time trying to perfect them. So instead, we have kind of nonsense words and nonsense phrases that don't make a lot of sense and just seem to be there because they sound good, where well-crafted lyrics really tell you a story. They show you the writer's emotion. They're really something important. So lyrics, perhaps with this chart, will actually gain some traction as something that lyricists and songwriters really have to pay more attention to. Let's hope so. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks of the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the famous Abbey Road Studios. And a couple of interesting things have happened over the past couple weeks. The first thing is they've launched something called Abbey Road Red. Now, what is it? It's a tech incubator, especially for music tech projects. So what's an incubator? Well, everyone knows what venture funding is, angel funding, or seed capital, and it's basically getting money to start up your company. Well, an incubator doesn't actually give you money or doesn't give you a lot of money, but what they give you is services. So in the case of Abbey Road, what they're going to do is they're going to provide mentorship and advice and a testing ground, which you can't ask for a better testing ground than Abbey Road. So there's an awful lot that they're providing here, and that's what most incubators do. And there's some money that gets shuffled in as well. And don't forget that Universal Music owns Abbey Road Studios. Remember, they bought EMI last year, and with that came Abbey Road. So Universal Music owns Abbey Road Studios, and as a result, their venture arm, and believe it or not, Universal Music actually does have a venture arm that's invested in a lot of different companies already, like Shazam is one, Beats was another one. Of course, they're in Spotify. And Uber, believe it or not, they're an early investor in Uber, but they kind of made a mistake in that they sold their shares way before Uber became valuable. So they actually didn't make any money on it. Anyway, they're backing Abbey Road Red, the tech incubator. Now, the way this also works at Abbey Road Red, they're taking three music tech startups every 6 months. So basically, it's a six-month program, but they're going to work with just three music tech startups. That being said, There's an awful lot of music tech companies out there, small little startups that could use the help, and this is a good place to start. You can go to abbeyroad.com/red to find out more and to apply if you're interested. Abbey Road is also doing something else that's interesting. They're coming out with the Abbey Road Institute, which is basically a recording school. It's a one-year recording school that supposedly teaches the EMI Abbey Road way of doing things. And that's probably well worth it because, let's face it, they've turned out great engineers for decades now. And everybody kind of raves about the upbringing that you get in that EMI Abbey Road system. So anyway, you can also check that out on the same page. Just go to abbeyroadstudios.com and you can find out everything about that as well as when they schedule tours. So if you're in London, boy, it's very cool to go there. My guest today is drummer Kelly Scott, who's played drums with the alternative rock band Failure off and on for about 20 years. In between, he was a member of the esteemed producer Linda Perry's studio band and drummed on projects by Christina Aguilera, Pink, Faith Hill, Hole, Scissor Sisters, and many more. Kelly was just off the road for a quick break when I spoke to him on the phone from his home in Los Angeles. Just so you know, we get geeky about drums in the first half of the interview and philosophical about the music business in the second half. When you go to Europe, for instance, are you taking your own drum kit or is there a rental there for you? How does that work?
No, basically what will happen is because I endorse Gretsch and Meinl cymbals, I will give my guys a call there and they will set up a drum set and a set of cymbals to be over there, wherever is the most convenient place for me to pick it up. And then I'll use that for all the dates over there. Yeah, it kind of works like that. And then next year, we're going to be doing a lot of that same thing where we'll be doing like fly-in dates, festivals and things like that. And I just call my rep at my drum and cymbal company, and they arrange drum sets and cymbals over there for me.
Well, that's convenient. Do you bring a snare or anything with you?
I have a snare that I predominantly use, so they call my little secret weapon. It's this weird snare I got maybe 5 or 6 years ago off of eBay, and I've never used anything else live.
Wow.
So yeah, I'll bring that with me and like a stick bag and probably a kick drum pedal.
What makes the snare so special?
Well, this particular one, most of the stuff I've been doing for the last few years, or at least touring stuff, tends to be on the more aggressive side. So this particular snare is pretty weighty. It weighs like somewhere between 34 and 37 pounds. So
wow.
I can either play it very softly or I can play it very hard. And the drum never chokes. It's super explosive. And the particular sound of it, I really like a lot.
How does it record?
It records great. It actually is the only snare that we used on the recording of our last record.
Wow.
The newest Failure record that came out in June. You know, I have like a bunch of snare drums, so when we were recording, I brought them all out there. And frankly, that one sounded so good, it never came off the drum set. You know, I would retune it to, you know, whatever track we were recording, so there weren't like any weird overtones or anything like that. And that kind of actually made it sound like more than one snare drum.
What's your kit like these days?
For the Failure stuff, I mean, it's pretty small. It's just one up, one down, and kick and snare, just a little four-piece. It's a 13-rack, 16-floor, and a 24 kick.
24-inch kick, wow, okay.
Yeah, but it's kind of a vintage layout. It's a 14 by 24.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so it's a little bit, like, thinner. The width of it isn't quite what you'd normally see nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the reason I pick the sizes of my drums is, and even the snare drum, is because I can get more out of them just by tuning them slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this one's so shallow, I can make it sound like a 22 just by pitching it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make it sound like a 26 by pitching it down really low.
So when you're touring, though, what do you do? Because you can only set it one way, right?
Yeah, I just set it one way. Nice and flappy. Almost the heads are about to fall off. Yeah, I like it like that. And I mean, when I do that, it tends to get like a broader spectrum of sound, like really, really lows and really, really highs.
Yeah. Do you have the front head on?
Yes.
With the hole?
Yeah, I've got a double ply on each side. There is a hole in it. I used one of those NS10s, inverted NS10s, for some sub on it.
Yeah.
But, I tuned both heads, like, pretty low. They're both two-ply heads, and I put very little padding inside of it.
Are they tuned the same?
No, one is, the one on the kick side is a P3, like a clear two-ply, and the one on the outside is, what am I using? I'm using a coated P4, and it's got our band's logo over top of it, which mm-hmm. dampens it just a little bit more on top of that.
Well, that's cool. How did you come to this setup? How did it evolve to this? Because I'm sure you've gone through a lot of iterations over the years.
Some of it is definitely, you know, experience, like studio experience, tuning drums, and sort of knowing how to get to that place where you can make a drum sound the way someone else wants it to.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of helped me, well, it definitely helped me sort of develop my own particular voice of where not only the sound of the drum resonates with me, but the way the drum feels to play.
Yeah, yeah.
Resonates with me. You know, because I want it to sound great, but at the same time, I want it to be comfortable to play. Like, I don't want to have to sort of exert myself or sort of mess with my technique. I don't want to have to adjust my technique to play something. So I sort of go from there. You know, I don't always, depending on the drum, I don't always get it to sound where it's easiest to play, but I try and keep that window as small as possible.
When you're in the studio, do you tune your own drums or do you bring drum doctors?
Yes.
Or yeah, you do.
Nope. I do all mine myself. And a lot of that, like, I've always kind of known where I like the drum to sound, but it wasn't until when you and I first met, when I was working for Linda Perry.
Yeah.
She had me basically not only playing all the drums on her records, but I was doing all of the teching as well. And that kind of started with me spending weeks just going through her massive drum collection and tuning all the drums, learning to tune them where they sounded best based on their particular depth and wood type and, you know, the heads I was putting on them. I think that's probably where I learned the most about the individual voices of drums. You know, before that, I think it was very much like, I'm just going to grab any drum and tune it the way I want it to sound.
Yeah.
As opposed to tuning the drum the way it wants to sound.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so there, I mean, you kind of have to take all that information and put it together and sort of, you know, like I said earlier, without having to mess with your technique or where you feel most comfortable playing, you know, try and find a small enough window that you feel comfortable and the drum sounds comfortable, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, how about heads?
Heads, I tend to, I mean, over the years, I haven't really changed all that much. I've always liked clear heads on the kick drum. And I've always liked coated dot heads on the snare. Over time, I have gotten a little bit thicker on my snare heads because I like them somewhere tuned, like somewhere in the middle to like just above the middle tightness. And you tend to get a lot of like weird overtones in that area. So I find the thicker the head, the less I have to struggle with those overtones.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not a big fan of changing heads all the time. I think it's kind of wasteful, and there's definitely a sweet spot where a drum really starts to fall in love with the head that's on it, and
yeah.
It sounds better when it's worn in a little bit. And because I do tend to, especially live, play hard, you know, all of that kind of, to use a famous Paul Ill phrase, dovetails together.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of that I use all of those components to choose what kind of head best suits my playing and the drum and having as many unwanted overtones as possible. And I used to use double ply coated heads for the toms. which I still do, but I've switched to those Evans Onyx, those black ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Those, I think they're really, really easy to tune. They're pretty rich sounding, and they're also pretty thick. So again, they don't have a lot of overtone to them. Cause I don't like to put muffling on drums at all. So those I can play with the tuning, like pretty wide open and no muffling. And again, there's not like a lot of crazy overtone to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're super durable. You know, I can leave them on for, I don't know, like up to a week and a half sometimes.
Wow.
And then after a week and a half, I just change them because I don't want to sacrifice for the way the drum sounds for just being lazy. You know, they still feel good. They still sound good. But, you know,
yeah.
I play pretty hard.
Well, you heard the Charlie Watts snare drum story, I'm sure, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where,
yeah.
The way it was told to me, it was an engineer who was working with them who shall remain nameless. And before the session, before the session started, his first session with them, he went to Charlie and says, "Well, don't you think you should change the head?" And he said, "Well, it's been working pretty good for 22 years."
Yeah.
He had enough.
No, I mean, exactly. And the way Charlie plays, he like a jazz player.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
His playing lends itself to leave a head on there for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? His wrists probably take more of the force than the drum head does because he has such a like nice light touch to his playing. I have a series of snares that I only use in the studio, and I don't change the heads on those.
Really?
Because I don't play in the studio. I play completely different than I do live.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I'm live. I'm more or less, my job is to beat the vitality out of the drum. So I'm kind of forced to change the heads more often. But I have this group of snare drums that I use only in studio, and those heads have been on there for years. I would never dream of changing those.
That's cool. I mean, you know, because the first thing like a drum tuner will do is change the heads always. You know, if you get one of the famous drum guys in, that's the first thing they'll do, and that's the first thing they always say you should do.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you have something on there that's working, why change it? And it sounds good. What's the difference, right?
Yeah, and I mean, some of those drum tuners, I mean, you also have to take into consideration that they have a high markup on their drum head, so it kind of suits their bottom line to change the drum head. You know. Without naming any names, you know, if it was my business, I mean, you know, practically speaking, that's something I may consider.
Yeah.
Also, you know, if I was changing dozens of drum heads a day for a living, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's all kind of relative. A new drum head always sounds great on a drum, you know, and sometimes, you know, leaving a head on there for a while is suited for the player that knows the drum. Because, you know, they can get quite finicky. I don't know if you want to leave finicky heads on a drum set when someone's coming in for, you know, $100 an hour.
Yeah, right.
To tune your drums. So, you know, I mean, there's definitely multiple ways of looking at it. Personally, if I can, like, I would much rather leave a drum head on there for as long as possible. But in saying that, like, I change my heads live every week and a half. But to this day, every time I take them off, like, I've never seen any like crazy or extreme pitting on the bottom, especially those tom heads, the black Onyx.
Yeah.
Like I play pretty hard and I have yet to change one of those heads and see like a stick mark, which, you know, they call pitting through the other side when you take it off.
Yeah. Right.
You know, normally you'll see a bunch of like, just dents in the head. I've never had that happen. Like these black Onyx heads are so durable.
What do you do with the heads then? Do you throw them away?
No, I either keep them around and save them for a rainy day. You know, depending on my finances, it's always good to have an option around.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes I'll sign them, you know, and give them away or maybe sell them at the merch booth to pay for all my sticks and heads that I've bought that tour. You know, it kind of varies, but I never throw them away.
Well, there's no point. Yeah. If you know, they're not broken and they're not pitted a lot. Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, if they're worth nothing to me, they're worth something to somebody else.
Yeah.
So I've definitely like signed a few heads and like given them away to, you know, fans of the band and stuff like that. And I mean, they go kind of crazy for stuff like that.
They're supposed to.
Yeah, I know. I still find all that old stuff weird. Like, you know, I'm just a guy that when he was a kid made a choice, just like anybody else. You know, why don't you treat teachers or people, you know, that like make a monumental difference in people's lives? And I'm always reconciling, like, you know, what I know what music does for me, and you know, it does that for other people. It takes you out of your life, and you know, it's just a little escape hatch where you can kind of disappear and unwind from whatever it is, you know, you go through from day to day. Still, I find that I'm most creative in my life, and probably even more so right-sized by not imagining myself as any more than, you know, just a 12-year-old kid that fell in love with playing drums.
That's such a cool approach. And I mean, you sound it too. Just, you can tell, you know, just talking to you that's the way you feel. You're not putting it on. It comes across very apparent.
How fortunate am I? Like, you know, that I get to do, especially, I mean, you know, I'll be 46 this year and I still get to do what I love to do, you know, and yeah. I've been given the gift to like be creative, to start from nothing and wind up with something.
Where did you grow up at?
A little bit of everywhere. My dad was on submarines.
Oh.
So I moved around quite a bit, not quite as much as my brother and sister. I think the moving around, my parents definitely realized that it might not be the best thing for kids.
Yeah.
You know, my brother and sister were sort of the inadvertent experiment. So with me, my dad got more of an opportunity to settle down in one place. So I moved to San Diego, Virginia, Boston, Connecticut, South Carolina. So I only moved 6 times. And I got to spend most of, I think, from 3rd grade to graduation in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, well, that's a good place. Florida's a great place for musicians. And there's so many great musicians that have come out of Florida, all different sections of Florida, too. It's very cool. And I think a lot of it had to do with there's always been a lot of opportunities to play down there. There's a lot of venues. And that has a lot to do with
it. Yeah, there were. And... Well, I mean, it's kind of odd because I think the moving around and getting used to and kind of embracing the fact that every, you know, 2 years you're going to have to move and say goodbye to everything set me up for even the years that I did spend, like we were on Navy bases, which are very, very secluded. They're like small towns and everything is in that town. So you don't really go outside of that area very much.
Mm-hmm.
But later on in, I think, like the middle of junior high or so, we moved off the Navy base and got a house. But by then, I was so deep in the daydream of moving somewhere to become a rock star that my feet weren't firmly planted in a way where, you know, people say, oh, I'm from somewhere.
Yeah.
I still, even to this day, I feel I'm more from Los Angeles than anywhere else because I've been here for so long.
Yeah.
And kind of grew up out here and learned how to be, you know, a functioning adult or human being out here. But in Florida, the one thing that I did get is when I started to become of age to find places to play, I always had to play with older guys. And there were a couple bars that I got to play in, like, you know, between the age of like, I guess, 12 and 16. And it was always like, you got to wait outside. And most of the time you had to play covers. And, you know, there was and there wasn't opportunity. Like, I definitely could have played music, but I couldn't have, there was less an opportunity to, like we were talking about earlier, create something of your own. And that is kind of what pushed me over the edge and made me, like, seek out Los Angeles more or less.
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. I had, you know, a very similar experience where I was playing 4 nights a week in bars when I was 16 years old. And,
uh-huh.
You know, there were times, I guess when I was still in high school, I was playing almost every night. So
right.
You get pretty good, but on the other hand, at this point, we're playing covers, and for the most part, you're proficient, but you're sloppy because you're not under that microscope yet.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And you kind of have to get away from all that and relearn things all over again. In my case, my band got a deal with the major label. We went to New York, and you know, we're in the big New York studio recording. And when that first playback came back, I was shocked at how bad I sounded. And And on this first album, what ended up happening was my parts were mostly replaced. You know, when I finally got this thing that you worked so hard for and put it on, it's like, that doesn't sound like me. That's because it wasn't. So.
Well, I was in a very similar situation. My first band out here that I recorded a record with, there were two drummers in the band. There was me and there was John Molo, the drummer from Bruce Hornsby.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You remember that guy? He plays with him now, John Fogerty.
John Fogerty, yeah.
But he, at the time, I think he was like probably mid or late 30s and had been like a pro drummer forever. And I was like 18 and kind of the same way, like really young and scrappy and had a certain energy, but did not know the first thing about what a drummer actually does besides show off. And I was fortunate that when we did our first record, Michael Beinhorn was producing the record. And he recognized this in me and sort of pulled me aside and was like, well, if you're like competing for space on this record, you're going to get slaughtered if you continue to do what you do. So he had the foresight to basically, we were recording up at the old Indigo Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
And he, over the weekend, he had one of the assistants put a drum set up in the bungalow and made me sit up there. Or actually, he didn't make me. He asked me. He was like, look, this is your chance. You know, you can do this and go ahead like you are, or you can take my advice and put in some work in the right direction. And he literally gave me Highway to Hell and was like, I want you to spend the entire weekend up there playing this record, but understanding what it is that makes this record and this drummer, Phil Rudd, such a great drummer. And he made me imagine, he's like, if there's a finish line, his kick drum is the first thing that crosses that finish line of all of the instruments. And that's what makes people dance and move. And I'd pretty much concentrated more on my hands and flash.
Yeah.
But that idea, I went up there and I shredded all weekend and managed to secure some space on the record. You know, if it wasn't for that, it would have been the same thing. Like my name would have been on the record, but John Molo would have played all the drums.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man. I am forever indebted to Michael for that. I think it was just last year, I managed to track him down and sent him an email, like sort of telling him, you know, my story. And he knows who Failure is. He knows Ken, our singer producer, pretty well. You know, I mean, it was those kinds of things. And I think, you know, what we were talking about earlier is like, you know, my humility, it doesn't necessarily come from, oh, I'm some sort of great guy. I think through trial and error, I've learned that by having humility, you're going to get a lot further in life. And in that particular moment, you know, at 18, other than siding with Michael Beinhorn, you know, and I'm not sure why. I mean, I definitely was pretty arrogant at that age. But for a second, like I had enough clarity that I heard what he was saying. And I got humble for a minute and embraced what he was saying. And, you know, instead of being a smart ass, I did what he said.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that small little window of humility, or at least just listening to someone else or taking someone else's instruction instead of your own, preserved what, you know, God, I mean, it's almost 20 years later, you know, what I call my career. I can't honestly say that I would have made it this far if I hadn't followed his instruction.
You know, it's funny. I interviewed Michael last year. And I said, you know, the rumor is that you fire lots of drummers because there's something especially going around the internet and over the last couple of years that, you know, how tough he is on drummers and everything. And he said, no, I don't fire drummers. I just hold them up to a certain level of excellence. And
exactly.
Either they have to cut it or they don't, and then I get somebody else.
Yes. Yeah, he doesn't fire them. The drummer fires themselves.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. That's brilliant, actually. It's the way to do
you
it.
You know, and even in another case, I mean, you have, to me, Michael Beinhorn is a brilliant producer because the first thing he does is he pulls aside, in his mind, the two most important things of any group, the drummer and the vocalist. And he tries to change them for the better. And a lot of times, those can be the most arrogant people in the band. He gets a lot of resistance, and he gets a huge bad rap. And immediately in saying that, the one thing that comes to mind, two of the most brilliant singers and drummer in one band in recent history, who could have done whatever they wanted because they were so brilliant and so talented, but Michael produced their record, and he turns them into better players because the singer less than the drummer, but the singer definitely, for the most part, or at least enough to make him better than when Michael found him.
Yeah, yeah.
The Soundgarden record, Super Unknown.
Oh, yeah.
Two brilliant musicians, but that, to me, is both of their quintessentially perfect performances on record.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Because neither one of them is showing off 100% of the time, like they're playing the song, and it's just beautiful. It's very Motown of them, which is like Michael's big thing. Like, he's all about Motown and singers and drummers, because he knows, like, those are the two things that will make or break a record.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
I think he's brilliant, and he gets a bad rap. You know, and I think most of that bad rap comes from, you know, people who, you know, not that they don't want to get better, but they fail to realize that the thing that will inevitably every time make them better is accepting input from the people around them.
Well, it's really easy to let your ego get in the way, and especially when you're younger.
And it is. It totally is. It totally is. And there's something inside of you that, like, tells you that that's what feels good.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, it totally doesn't work. I mean, I am absolutely a product of all the wonderful musicians I've played with. What I do is a reaction to the music that they provide me. Plain and simple. I'm nothing without them. I'm just another guy beating on a really noisy, unmusical instrument.
But really, other musicians could say the same thing, because when it's all said and done, it's that symbiosis between everybody that really makes it work. You know, the whole is greater than the parts.
Yes. Yeah. But how often do you hear people actually say that?
Well, it happens less and less, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I literally could open up a drum magazine and page after page after page after page after page, and, you know, guitar magazine, vocal magazine, entertainment magazine, every single magazine, you will hear or read people go on about themselves.
Yeah.
They love to talk about themselves page after page after page after page. And more times than not will you ever hear them, even one sentence, what I do is a product of the talented people that I work with.
Yeah.
I would not be as good as I am had I not worked with talented people that pushed me to be better than what I am.
Yeah, yeah. And let's face it.
That's where greatness comes from.
Yeah.
Whether it's a Charlie Parker or a John Bonham or, you know, all of these people that through time, actors, musicians that we look up to and say they're geniuses and they're great. And all of them had somebody or something that inspired them to move forward beyond themselves.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely. And it's so easy when you're on the other side to resist that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to get back to you in the studio for a second here. Tell me about the headphone mix that you prefer. We're getting geeky here.
I prefer, I mean, it varies. It definitely varies. When, like, say I play, for example, with Paul Ill,
yeah,
I like a lot of bass. A lot of it depends on who I'm playing with. You know, I've been known to record stuff where there's just vocals and a click track.
Do you like recording that way?
No, I mean, a lot of it depends on, I like to get in and get out, because for me, I feel like my moment of inspiration isn't long. I like to finish my drum tracks while I'm still inspired by the music I'm listening to. And sometimes not everyone in the studio is going to have the same skill set. I like to be inspired, and I tend to learn things like arrangements and things really, really quickly. And if there's someone in the accompanying band who doesn't learn things quickly or isn't inspired and is just kind of walking through it, and you can sort of feel that, or you might have one guy who really feels the pressure and getting it right is the most important part. Like, you can feel the energy of him thinking about things. You know, it depends. I usually adjust what I'm listening to in like the first like one to like two or three takes. And that is based on just me not losing my window of inspiration. It's less based on everyone else and more based on me getting through it quickly so I don't lose that inspired moment. The magic, you know, where you play things that you don't think about. It's just a pure unconscious reaction to the music you're listening to. So I usually adjust my mix to that.
Well,
that's why I say, like, I've been known to record a drum track with just vocals and a click track. Because I don't want to be distracted by all of the other things that are going on with everybody else.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can walk in a room and you just have that. I mentioned Paul.
Yeah.
Like, he and I, no matter how much time we spend apart, whenever we get in a room together, we have that magic. And he is always a reliable partner.
Yeah.
You know, it's not based on whether he's playing that great or whether he's remembering the arrangement. There's just some way that he and I, like, really, we're feeling what we listen to the same. So we stick together like glue. You know, and it's great. I would prefer to have a foundation to record by. But if it's a question of having that or the window of inspiration, I'll pick the window of inspiration every time. You know, I've recorded a drum track to just a click track,
yeah,
and I've turned everybody else down. You know, sometimes I turn everybody up because it's just magical and perfect. And, you know, it's what every drummer wants, like that great band, ensemble. But I feel that the inspired moment is way more important than how good or bad you play with the other musicians in the room.
Well, how long is that inspirational moment then? For you?
You know, it varies. I mean, again, it's all so, it's different from every single experience. It's not really quantifiable. Like for example, when we did the new Failure record, I haven't played with these guys in 20 years. And when we got in a room and played together, like, we have a certain musical language. Like, the way we respond to one another is that thing that we call failure. And we play well together, and it's not perfect, but there's just a certain, the way we play together, that cohesiveness and all constantly moving in the same direction and, you know, vibing off of one another. You know, you don't always get that. More often than not, you don't get that at all. No matter how good, you know, the musicians in the room with you are, you know, it's this weird, like, how well do they know you? Do they trust you? Do they find you funny? Are they threatened by you? Like, there's so many, did that guy drink too much coffee? Like, there's so many variables that can affect what you're doing in that moment.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. The band I was telling you about, you know, earlier when we did the first album that I ever did, we weren't together for 15 years, and I went back for sort of a reunion, and it was amazing. The first bar, it was just so big, and it was like there was no time that went by. It was just amazing. It was a great feeling. One of the best feelings I have ever had, I got to say, in music.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's such a high.
Yeah.
Like, that's the moment that you search for when you play music.
Yep, yep. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen enough, but
no, I mean, you know, sometimes you could be playing with like the greatest musicians in the world. And for whatever day, for whatever reason that day, they're just like really kind of flat and uninspired.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make them a bad musician. That just makes them human.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. You were talking about the period of inspiration there, and I did this book with Ken Scott. Ken Scott, of course, was one of the five Beatle engineers and produced four or five Bowie albums. And he told me that all of those great Bowie records, for the most part, the basic tracks were all done in one or two takes, and they rarely got to three. Yeah. And when I went and I talked with Trevor and the drummer, I can't think of his name. Anyway, the drummer from the Spiders. And I asked him about it, and they said, we were so pissed because just about the time we learned the song, Bowie would go, okay, next. But yet you listen to all those records, and they sound
That's
great.
Exactly how when we, like, all of the Linda records, like, she is all about, like, that. And I mean, I don't know if I ever heard her say that inspired moment.
Yeah.
But it was all about, like, getting it done as quickly as possible, not because you're lazy and you want to get out of there, but because there's, like, there's this fine space in between reacting to the music and really not knowing where you're going and knowing the song too well that you already know what you're going to play.
Yeah, right.
There's
right.
this, like, space right in between that. Like, with the new Failure record and even the last Failure record, I mean, each one of those, one's, like, 62 minutes long, the other one's, like, 64 minutes long, which is a lot of material. I think we spent, like, you know, maybe 18 hours on drum tracks. We would write, and we the way we work is when we come up with an idea, we write from start to finish, and that usually takes, like, you know, the day. It takes the day to write the song without vocals more times than not, just the music. And then the next day I come in and I'm responsible for a drum track. Or sometimes at the end of that same day that we've been writing it, that's when I record my drum track and it is etched in stone for the rest of time.
That is so cool, because most producers, most players would say, oh, I can do that better. Let me go back and fix that or whatever. And really, you just make it different, not necessarily better at that point.
Exactly. Exactly. Very fine point.
Yeah.
You can make it different for, you know, infinity. You know, and even a lot of that is I make my choices of what I like and love about the song through the other guys.
Yeah, yeah.
If I get caught up in deciding for myself what I think is great, I'm always going to opt for doing it again, because in my mind, I can always make it better.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's when having musicians that you know and trust in there to sort of help you sift through yourself and your desire to be great and balance it out with your desire to record a great song.
Well, okay. That being said, when you look back at those records, is there anything that you would say, I wish I had another shot at that?
No, no. And it's funny you say that, because, like, just speaking of the Failure records, in 1996, when we recorded that record, we did it the same exact way we did this new one that just came out in June. But my experience level at that time had me really, really frustrated and really just kind of crazy. I had never, like, written a drum track while the arrangement, you know, oh, this part's awesome. And then someone's like, oh, I don't like the musical part. Throw it away. Go back to this. Okay, instead of doing that four times, let's do it eight times. Yeah, eight times doesn't work. Let's do it 10 times. You know, that constant, like writing and arranging where you're remembering your parts and then you're throwing them away two takes later. And then you're maybe adding something from 10 takes ago back in while trying to forget the thing you've been working on for six takes. And I got really, really jumbled up and really was just too thoughtful. And my experience up until that point never prepared me for anything like that. And when I listen back to the record, the main thing I hear is the way I felt. Like, I can literally go back to that moment and see just how exasperated I was with this overwhelming process that I just was not comfortable with. I think the drum tracks themselves, I would say, like, 99.9% of them, given the circumstances, there's so much beauty and energy and vitality And again, the relationship between the three of us, like finding our way, like they had never done a record like that either. And we did it all ourselves, no engineers, no producers, just the three of us writing and recording in a house for 6 months. Flash forward, you know, there are a couple things like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have played that fill. But it's usually when I think of that, my second choice is I wished I hadn't played anything at all there.
Right.
I wish I just left that space. Flash forward to today, for the first time in my entire career, I mean, you know, from 1987 to where we are today, I've recorded a record that when I listen to it, like every single moment is supposed to be there. Every single moment was relaxed. Every single moment was a labor of love and really easy and not like thought about, or it was just absolutely perfect. It was perfect. Our relationship together, like when I played a drum track and the other guy said, dude, that was great. You're done. I didn't fight what they said. I just moved on. Like everything about the process was absolutely perfect. But the reason I was able to be at that place, I mean, you know, part of it is, as you know, I'm sober now. Mm-hmm. And when I got sober, I gained a lot of tools about being a human being, you know, being able to trust people and rely on other people and to live in the moment, realize that the moment is the most perfect thing that you will ever experience. Dovetailing that with the wealth of experience, you know, mainly Linda Perry's place, working 5 days a week where you had to get it right, but you weren't allowed to think about it. And you had to just react and be unconscious and in love with what you were doing and inspired. Those two things together created the perfect moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the major difference. I mean, again, you know, we're talking and it's like so fortunate that like if I don't get to play drums beyond today, I lived long enough that I got to experience, in my mind, the most perfect, absolute moment.
Kelly, that's so rare. There are so few players that can say that.
Well, you know, I think they can say that. They just don't know.
Well, maybe that's
true.
They
don't know. Like, they're always, you know, tomorrow is another day where I can have it better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are like two things I say in the morning and two things I say at night when I wake up and when I go to bed. Thank you for what I have and thank you for what I don't have.
That's great. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, today's it. Today's it. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe tomorrow there's a day where, you know, my experience playing music will be even better. Who knows? I have no idea.
Yeah.
What I do know is today I've decided that I've already experienced the most perfect moment, which leaves me open to probably experiencing an even better moment.
Yeah, you're right.
Because I'm not looking for it.
You're right. That's cool. Okay, one last question. What's the best piece of music business advice, music advice that either you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
Well, I mean, as a player in the music business, I would say make certain, know that you love playing music before you even go forward. You know, that's the thing that will, for me anyway, kept me going. Most of my career, I never made a dime, you know, and it was very, very early on that I asked myself, like, okay, I'm not going to be able to have an apartment. I'm not going to be able to have a girlfriend. I'm not going to be able to have all these things that normal people get to have. Do I love playing music enough that that's okay? That for me was probably the most important knowledge that I imparted on to myself. I wouldn't change anything about my musical career. I don't think I have ever deserved anything more than just that. Like being in love with what I do was enough to keep me doing it all these years. But, you know, the other piece of information is for just the average person, learn everything there is to know about it. Don't be lazy. Don't expect someone else to do all the work for you. You know, it's one thing to be a talented player. It's another thing to be a talented player that doesn't know anything about, like, ours is the only business where you'll wake up and go, oh, I'm going to start this business of playing drums or playing music. But for some weird reason, I'm not going to learn the marketing, or I'm not going to learn the PR, or, you know, all of those other things that are absolutely vital. Like, you create the product and then you decide not to learn how to put it out into the world and be successful at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can't think of another another business, small business, where, like, some guy would make clothes and not open up a store and advertise the store, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because what happens is, if you leave somebody else in charge of everything and it doesn't work out, it's always someone else's fault. When in reality, it's never their fault, it's your fault, because you made the choice to put the thing that you love most in life in their hands. How are they supposed to make that successful? They will never love it as much as you do.
You're right.
You know, it's like having a child and, like, asking someone else to take care of it. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like, why would you do that? You love this child so much. You know, the child's going to grow up and, like, you know, you will have paid for everything, but its personality and the way it acts in the world is going to be the result of whoever that person was taking care of it.
Yeah, right, right.
It's not going to be you. You know, and I mean, music is the same thing. It's like, you know, if you're going to learn to play and love music, you had better learn to play and love the business.
Well, it's called the music business for a reason, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, granted, maybe, you know, you'll never have the resources to become rich and famous or any of that kind of stuff. But I mean, that's not practical either. You know, the ultimate goal is, can I pay my bills and live a life where, you know, I'm happy with the results of my work?
Well, as they would say, making a living is the new success.
For sure. And I mean, the only reason why is the people that used to, you know, quote unquote, take care of everything for the musician are out of business. You know, so now the musician's kind of forced to do some of the work themselves.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And, you know, I find that much better. I mean, I come from the old school where, you know, you imparted all the work to somebody else to take care of. And, you know, frankly, I did that because I was afraid and I was lazy.
Join the club is all I can say. Yeah,
we all did
that at one point in time.
Yeah, and then, you know, we carry around the resentment that, you know, it's somebody else's fault that our dreams didn't come true.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, granted, you know, maybe we didn't know any better, you know, the circumstances of the record business and the climate and the culture and the information was completely different then. I think most of us were led to believe that that was the system that we had to work within, and that's the way you're supposed to do it if you want to be successful.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if I had ever met a musical entrepreneur back then that did it themselves.
Well,
you know, everybody was looking for the same thing I was looking for.
I mean, unconsciously, what I've found is there's, you know, people that are very successful tend to market themselves unconsciously, and they're really good at it, but yet it's just part of their DNA. It's not something that they learn, because let's face it, it's not an easy thing to learn. And for some people, it's very difficult to promote themselves.
Yeah.
So
yes.
I know I was like that forever.
No, I'm still that way. I mean, I still struggle with these things. I just managed to get beyond my struggle with them more times than not.
Mm,
you know, there's still definitely moments where I could be doing better at something. But I recognize in myself that the only thing that really holds me back is, you know, the fear of not being successful at something, especially if other people are looking.
Well, Kelly, this has been great. I've really enjoyed the chat.
Oh, likewise.
You're really an interesting guy, and I loved getting, you know, deep in the weeds in some of this with you, because we don't get a chance. Anyway, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Bobby. I really appreciate your, like, reaching out to me. That really means a lot.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyinnercircle.com. We love your questions and we love your comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Steve helps put the show together. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and now Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOinnerCircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.